fear and hope offered to God should not be offered to anyone and anything else. This is the path to man's perfection, because it emancipates human heart and soul from all other types of worship.
Idol worshipping is considered a great sin, and the reason for this is because the very feeling instilled in man to bring him closer to God is diverted to leave him further away from God.
When you have a relationship with the one who is all perfect, because that's who he is, and he is the most beautiful, and he's the most perfect, and he's the most loving, then you want to emulate those qualities in your life. You want life around you to be more and more beautiful. You want more and more love in your life. You want more and more, you know, better and better things in your life. Because at the end of the day, this quest will come to a conclusion when you finally meet him and you actually get to see perfection itself.
But should we fear God or love him? Are fear and love compatible with each other? The Quran actually advises us that at the same time that we love God, we have to fear him as well. And different experiences of fear are mentioned in the Quran, or different levels of fear. Taqwa, khashya, shafaqa, rahba are but some examples.
The relationship between fear and love is one which is seen as a dynamic in Islam, okay, and often portrayed as such. They can be two sides of the same coin, okay, and fear and love are not wholly incompatible. Absolutely not are they wholly incompatible. Having said that, the predominant ethos of the Quran is one of love, okay, as is encapsulated in that repeated reference to God as being Rahman and being Rahim, the unqualified giver.
Every relationship comes with love and fear. Why is it so hard to understand with God? We have to love him, and we have to be afraid that he might be upset about something. But if your relationship in this world, if your relationship is only love and you're never afraid, like if I think about my wife, yeah, I love her, but I'm never afraid of disappointing her. I'm never worried about saying something that might hurt her feelings. I might think the relationship is perfect, but she might actually think that I don't care about her anymore. If my relationship with her is only about fear, oh my God, she's going to get angry. If I say something, she's going to get so mad, right? Then over time, I will lose all love for her. All that's left is fear.
We have to start with loving him. Once we base our understanding on rationality, then you cannot but love him. Fear, of course, there are consequences to our decisions. These consequences can be consequences between us and God, or things that affect people around us. Punishments is part of the equation, is part of the existence. You take the wrong decision. The Quran states is that not that God has ascribed certain punishments to this wrong decision. Your wrong decision itself in reality has these negative consequences.
Taqwa is the beginning of all those different levels of fear, and it is the beginning of worship. It is faith put to application. It is fear of losing God's support and trying to win his favor. But our fear of God is not purely for the consequences. It is sometimes an awesome experience of his greatness.
Khashya is a fear as a result of knowledge and leads to action. It is when you know the greatness and the magnitude of what you fear, and as a result, you have reverence of it. There is another type of fear mentioned in the Holy Quran, which is referred to as rahb. Rahb is the kind of a fear that makes you very alert, very careful, and does not let you relax. It is like type of fear that the students have during exam time. They're careful, they're restless, and they're concerned about their passing. It is also fear that you are afraid that you will disappoint the one you love. The final type of fear which is mentioned is shafaqa. Shafaqa is the fear that some harm will come to a person you love. It is that type of fear. It is a fear that is mixed with love, such as the love of a mother for her children. She is fearful out of love for them.
If worshipping God is so important for the perfection of man, what happens if it is directed to concepts, objects, or persons other than God?
It's a divergence from the straight path. Does it have consequences? It does. Because we are meant to direct our thoughts and our actions with the unlimited being that is God. Once we attach ourselves to a limited form of existence, i.e. any form of an idol, because he's limited, our journey towards perfection will be very limited and very short, and it will hinder our progress towards perfection. So to free ourselves and to go back on the straight path to that endless journey towards the absolute perfection, we need to be free from idol worshipping and direct this energy and this fellowship to God and God only.
Well, when you worship your own desires, for example, avid materialistic culture, avid individualism, you have social breakdown and decay. If you look at the Children's Society report that was published in 2009, it came to the conclusion that our societies are breaking down because of what? Avid, excessive individualism. What's in it for me? I'm all right, Jack. And that, in a way, is worshipping the ego, is worshipping a false god. So it does have negative consequences in society, definitely.
Associating partners with God is an utter misjudgment. Now that's because Allah is the reality, and what he invokes besides him is nullity. Chapter 22, verse 62, he is the only source of good, perfection, or existence. This implies those who evoke others besides him are under an illusion.
But fear is only one leg of worship. The other very important component of worship is hope. Hope to go closer to God and to be included in His favor and mercy. Hope to be good enough to be loved by God and to be granted His love in our hearts. It's only through these two components of fear and hope that the true worship is realized. And that is something that should be offered only to God and no one but God. In fact, it is through worshipping God that we can expand and develop our God-given faculties. Associating partners with God would not only stop that process, but it is showing ingratitude towards our Creator. It is only by acknowledging that all beauty comes from God and all praise is due to Him that man can be accomplished. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk more about the creation of man. Until then, peace be with you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
فهل من مدكر
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we started explanation of Surah Muddassir, the 74th in order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It has 56 ayahs and was revealed in Mecca as commandment for public proclamation of the message of monotheism without fear of the ringleaders of the pagan Arabs, who were conspiring against the Prophet's secret preaching of Islam. It opens by addressing the Prophet as Muddassir, or the one wrapped in a mantle. It warns the obstinate disbelievers of their faith on the Day of Judgment, and a specific opponent of the Prophet is singled out in Ayah 11. Towards its end, the surah exposes the foolishness of the disbelievers' attitude to divine revelation and the Day of Resurrection. It is narrated from the Prophet's 15th infallible heir, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, that whoever recites Surah Muddassir in the obligatory ritual prayers shall be elevated to accompany the Prophet, and will be immune from the misfortune in this worldly life, provided he or she pays precise attention to its contents and acts upon them. We continue from where we left you last Friday, and here are ayahs 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20.
ثم يطمع أن أزيد كلا إنه كان لآياتنا عنيدا سأرهقه صعودا إنه فكر وقدر فقتل كيف قدر.
Still he is eager that I should give him more. No indeed, he is an obstinate opponent of our signs. Soon I will overwhelm him with hardship. Indeed, he reflected and decided. Perish he! How he decided! Again, perish he! How he decided! You might recall, in our previous episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we explained the divine condemnation of Walid ibn Mughayre, who was one of the avowed rejecters of Islam, a sworn enemy of the Prophet, and a thanklessly avaricious mischief maker, in spite of the fact that he had been granted wealth, health, children, and social prestige by the Almighty Creator. He used to call the Prophet of Islam a magician and discouraged people from hearing the recitation of the Noble Quran. A pagan to his very core, in the end, he died in utter misery, disgrace, and poverty, witnessing against his wishes the acceptance of Islam by three of his sons. Such types of obstinate deniers of truth are found in every age, and we should be cautious of their mischief. The ayahs that we recited to you now are divine condemnation of Walid ibn Mughayre and his negative characteristics that that made him crave for more wealth. Here, God Almighty seals his fate by warning of the hardship to afflict him because of his mockery of divine signs and his gathering of pagans to devise sinister plots against the prophet. The ayahs point out that, as the principal evil brain, he used to reflect on his satanic inclinations and decide what blasphemous words should be used against the prophet. For such devilish decisions, the divine wrath of perish for him resounds in ayahs 19 and 20. From these ayahs, we learn that, number 1, greed and thanklessness brings about the downfall of the wealthy. Number 2, the obstinate pagan Walid ibn Mughayre is cited as an example of the negative nature of those whose thirst for wealth never quenches even if the entire world happens to fall to their share. Number 3, a faithless person, even if smart and proud of the sharpness of his mind to devise devilish plans against truth and the believers, never succeeds. And number 4, in precaution towards the vowed enemies of faith and pronouncing curse upon them are necessary in order to expose their blasphemous designs. Now let us listen to ayahs 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25 of the same surah.
ثم قتل كيف قدر ثم نظر ثم عبس وبسر ثم أدبر واستكبر فقال إن هذا إلا سحر يؤثر.
Then he looked, then he frowned and scowled. Then he went away disdainfully, saying, "It is nothing but magic handed down. It is nothing but the speech of a human being."
These ayahs continue to focus on the crafty pagan Walid ibn Mughayre, who, despite knowing the flawless wisdom of the Noble Quran, refused to accept the truth. And after thinking in his devilish mind how to reject it, he disdainfully called it the magical words of a mere human being. He tried to unify the pagans of Mecca against Islam, but having failed in his designs, he frowned, scowled, and accused the prophet's preaching of monotheism and virtue to guide the people towards God Almighty as bewitching words that lead to separation between men and women, masters and slaves, and parents and children. These ayahs teach us that, number 1, we should not be negligent of the plots and stratagems of the enemies of Islam, because their devilish brains are always planning against truth and how to harm believers. Number 2, the obstinate disbelievers arrogantly consider themselves as superior and rightful, while depriving others of their rights. And number 3, the flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom of the Noble Quran makes the obstinate disbelievers speechless, and that's why they call it as magic. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30 of Surah Muddassir.
إن هذا إلا قول البشر سأصليه سقر وما أدراك ما سقر لا تبقي ولا تذر لواحة للبشر عليها 19
Soon I shall cast him into Sagar. And what will show you what is Sagar? It neither spares nor leaves anything. It burns the skin. There are 19 keepers over it. The Arabic word Sagar refers to the most scorching and lowest part of hell, where obstinate disbelievers like Walid ibn Mughayre, who never stopped their devilish designs to try to insult the Prophet, distort truth, and prevent people from accepting Islam, will be thrown. The fire in Sagar burns not just the skin, but the entire body, including the soul. The terrible torment of hellfire neither takes the life of the condemned persons, nor does it keep them alive, but they are entangled all the time in a state between life and death. Elsewhere, the Noble Quran has mentioned that whenever the body of the inmates of hell burns, new skin and flesh grows to burn again, and this torment continues all the time. As Ayah 30 says, there are 19 angels of divine wrath keeping constant watch over the disbelievers and deniers of truth burning in hellfire. From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number 1. It is not possible to properly understand the torments of the various parts of hell other than what God Almighty has revealed in the Noble Quran and what the Prophet and his infallible heirs have elaborated on divine command. And number 2, both body and soul will be resurrected on the Day of Judgment, which means the true believers shall fully enjoy and taste the bounties of paradise, while those cast in hell undergo punishments and tortures.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Over the past few weeks, the long-standing tensions between Iran and the Israeli regime have erupted into open conflict, as recent events have brought their shadow war into the spotlight. The escalation began on April 1st with Israel's reckless attack on Iran's consulate in Damascus, a flagrant violation of international laws and norms. In response, Iran retaliated on April 13th with a swift and forceful strike under the codename of Operation True Promise to ensure that no aggression against its soil would go unanswered. As the world still watches with growing unease and the specter of a wider regional conflict still looms large, Operation True Promise has already changed the trajectory of regional developments in favor of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the region as a whole. Tehran's retaliatory attack has forced Israel to recoil from its aggressive position. This can contribute to durable peace if continues in one of the most volatile parts in the world. Iran's retaliatory attack on Israel marks a new chapter in the history of the region. It is the most serious message ever from Tehran to Tel Aviv that enough is enough. By choosing to retaliate openly and decisively, Iran has demonstrated its resolve and willingness to defend its interests against perceived threats from Israel. To know more, we sat with Mr. Amir Mousavi, former Iranian diplomat and director of Asfar Strategic Institute.
یک سیاستی بود جمهوری اسلامی ایران دنبال میکرد و اون صبر استراتژیک.
Iran had long kept its strategic patience because it did not want to escalate tensions in the region. But this time round, Iran changed its approach by shifting from strategic patience to strategic confrontation. It was a show of force and a reminder that Iran's patience should not be misinterpreted as Iran's weakness in the face of the Israeli regime. With a recent operation, Iran once again showed that it can challenge Israel both directly and at will.
Operation True Promise involved a strategic use of drones and missiles in four waves. The initial wave featured suicide drones, mainly Shahed 136 types, to disrupt enemy aerial surveillance and divert their resources away from Iran's missiles. Cruise missiles, likely first-generation Pavet types, were launched from mobile truck launchers with speeds of over 700 to 900 kilometers per hour. These missiles could navigate complex routes and evade enemy air defenses due to their speed and low-altitude flight capabilities. The operation's main component was ballistic missiles, such as Desful, Qiyam 2, Rezvan, Khaybar Shekan 1, Emad, and Qadr, with ranges from 1,000 to 1,950 kilometers, making interception difficult. This is Mohammad Hossein Qurbani, a military expert with a specialty in hybrid warfare.
It is important to note that emerging technologies like drones are gradually taking a more significant role in wars. What Iran did in using drones was unprecedented. The operation on the whole was done with great mastery and precision and achieved its goals by striking the intended targets.
Videos from the operation showed missile flights, engagements with enemy air defenses, and targeted explosions. Iran's comprehensive operation forced the enemy to reveal their capabilities, providing valuable insights for future conflicts. Meanwhile, we asked Mr. Amir Ali Abolfat about the recent developments. He is an international affairs expert based in Tehran.
Australia در این 7-8 ماه گذشته دو تا شکست اطلاعاتی عمده خورده.
Over the past 7-8 months, the Israelis have had two major intelligence mistakes. The first one occurred on October the 7th. Back then, the Israelis were under the impression that Hamas would not attack them because they thought the group was too weak to take action against the regime. But it turned out that they were totally wrong. Their second mistake happened on April the 1st, when they targeted Iran's consulate in Syria. Again, they were under the impression that Iran would not respond to the attack directly, but through its allies in the region. They thought that Iran would not dare to attack a, let's say, nuclear state, and that Iran would not play that high-risk game. They couldn't imagine that Iran would attack the regime from its own soil. Again, they were wrong.
Iran's attack didn't mean to inflict human casualties. The target was Israel's deterrence. The regime has already learned to rue the day it attacked Iran's consulate in Damascus. Dr. Said Reza Ameli of the World Studies Faculty at Tehran University told us more about Iran's recent operation.
به نظر میاد که 26 فروردین 14 آوریل یه روز تاریخی.
April 13 marked a significant moment in both the West Asian region and global dynamics. Iran's retaliatory strike against Israel, a regime known for disregarding the rights of other nations for its own gain came as a surprise. Previously challenged, Israel's actions were met this time with a decisive response from Tehran. This event halted the cycle of violence and exposed vulnerabilities with the regime. Despite being on high alert and aided by nearly 10 countries, Iran successfully dealt a heavy blow to Israel without causing collateral damage.
It is obvious that the Iranian response was a major strategic defeat for the Zionists. While they boasted about 99% of the drones and missiles being intercepted, it is clear that the main targets were hit. But the degree of destruction caused was not the point of the operation. The point was to indicate that despite the much vaunted air defense systems and the direct military support given by the US, UK, and Jordan, with indirect help from France and Saudi Arabia, among others, Tehran can evade the defenses of the Zionist regime at will. As a result, a new equation of deterrence is being spoken of. How do you assess Iran's recent retaliatory drone and missile strike on Israel? Do you consider it as a successful attack? If so, in what ways was it successful?
Please note that on April 13th, Iran did not challenge only Israel, but almost half of NATO, namely the United States of America, France, and the UK, which are the three major members of the organization. That night, there was a match going on between Iran's defensive capabilities and half of the West's defensive capabilities. And in the end, it was a success for Iran. The country sent drones and missiles from a distance of like 1,700, 1,800 kilometers away that managed to penetrate multiple defensive layers before hitting the targets. In the Nevatim airbase alone, they landed missiles at six different points, as satellite images have revealed.
As the repercussions of Iran's attack reverberate throughout the region, Israel finds itself facing the consequences of its earlier actions. The regime's decision to target Iran's consulate in Damascus has now come back to haunt it. Due to the significantly small size of the territory it occupies, the Zionist regime does not have the strategic depth to absorb a large conventional attack without massive damage to its industrial, military, and civilian infrastructure.
The Islamic Republic has had two notable military confrontations so far. The first one refers to the eight-year war imposed by Saddam Hussein. In this war, the Iraqi dictator was supported by world powers, but in the end, he was defeated. The other one is Operation True Promise. In this military action, the world powers not only backed Israel, but also fought alongside Israel against Iran. And yet, the regime had a humiliating failure. We'll see the ramifications of this defeat in the future.
After the attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria, the Israelis craved a knee-jerk reaction for a catastrophic escalation while in for a strike that would deter without causing a big escalation. Much to the dismay of Netanyahu's warmongering cabinet, Iran achieved both. This event marked the first time a regional state effectively displayed its military strength and showed how vulnerable Israel is to such attacks, breaking down Israel's strong defense image and making it pay a price.
The Islamic Republic proved that it can use modern weaponry to punish Israel. Iran managed to shatter the regime's invincibility myth, and this is the heaviest blow to the regime. Iran has exposed the soft underbelly of Israel, and the regime will have a hard time to recover from it. Last but not least, Israel wanted to drag Iran into a bigger war, but the country managed to turn the table. Now the war is once again back to the occupied territories, and I can say within Israeli society itself, as people are becoming more and more critical of Netanyahu's belligerent policies.
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of the program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Ayatollah Khamenei says Iran demonstrated its power against Israel. Iran's leader Ali Khamenei thanked the country's armed forces for their attack this month on Israel, saying, the country had demonstrated its power regardless of how many targets were hit, Iran's official news agency reported on Sunday. Quoting from Ayatollah Khamenei, Reuters writes, "How many missiles were launched and how many of them hit their target is not the primary question. What really matters is that Iran demonstrated its power during that operation." World urges de-escalation after drones shot down over Iran. Escalation more than 6 months into Israel's war on Gaza has raised fears of spiraling violence across the region. Al Jazeera writes, Iran fired air defense batteries to shoot down three drones over the central city of Isfahan after officials in the United States told U.S. broadcasters that Israel carried out military operations against Iran. Explosions were reported on Friday in the sky over the cities of Isfahan and Tabriz. There has been no official comment from Israel. Iran once had air inferiority after its attack on Israel. It flies high. Iran's unprecedented April 14th attack on Israeli territory was a warning shot. It showed Tehran's potential ability to put a dent in Israel's formidable air superiority despite essentially its lacking a modern air force. Atlantic Council writes, the direct Iranian air attack on Israeli soil was a watershed moment in the region's steadily deteriorating security status quo. It revealed nothing new about Iran's military capabilities, but it suggested the alarming potential for Iran to exploit Israel's lack of strategic depth and showed a frightening willingness on the part of Tehran's leadership to outmatch Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recklessness. Iran-Israel conflict, Strait of Hormuz blockade could trigger oil and LNG price surge, analysts warn. Money Control writes, analysts have warned that if Iran were to block the Strait of Hormuz, a vital passage for countries like India to import crude oil from Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and the UAE, both oil and LNG prices could soar, potentially leading to inflation spikes. Iran and Israel may have taken a step back from a catastrophic regional war. Iran says it has no plans to retaliate after drones presumably launched by Israel are shot down. CBC News writes, as the sun rose over both Iran and Israel Friday morning, the details of what happened overnight near the Iranian city of Isfahan remained convoluted. But as the hours passed, as initial sense of fear and apprehension gradually gave way to relief. It appears, for the moment anyway, that both adversaries are signaling they want to end a warring spiral of strike and counterstrike and reestablish some guardrails in their intensely adversarial relationship that has threatened to engulf the Middle East in a wider regional war. Thank you for joining us in this section. Please, let's go back to the main narrative.
Iran's attack on Israel on April 13th is still in the headlines. While its multifaceted aspects are open to interpretation, there's one thing undeniable. It was a remarkable feat for Iran and a humiliating defeat for Israel. For Iran, the successful execution of the attack served as a demonstration of its military capabilities and willingness to assert itself on the regional stage. By targeting Israel's security infrastructure, Iran demonstrated its ability to confront adversaries directly and forcefully. The attack not only caused physical damage, but also dealt a blow to Israel's confidence, symbolizing a victory for Iran in the ongoing conflict.
The critics of Iran's military action against Israel argued that you cannot confront Israel. They said the regime is too strong to be confronted and it's insane to go to war with it. They said let Israel do whatever it wishes. In other words, they have come to terms with the regime's crimes. Iran, however, has debunked this argument. The regime can no longer commit crimes, violate international laws, and attack other countries with impunity.
In order to minimize damage, Iran deliberately overlooked the most important element of military thinking, operational surprise. The goal was not maximum destruction, but to strengthen deterrence, set new boundaries, and change the rules of engagement with Israel. Despite the massive help from its Western allies, the multiple successful hits, especially on the Nevatim base, were especially significant, given that the base hosts the extremely expensive F-35s, the Israeli Air Force's biggest asset and is protected by the densest anti-missile defense in the world, including the TPY-2X band radar, one of the best American assets to detect ballistic missiles.
We saw that Israel's multi-billion systems did not have a great performance in the face of Iran's military action. That is because Iran has managed to achieve superiority in some emerging technologies that has resulted in Iran's unbelievably increased power. I call it a strategic surprise because the enemy did not expect such a quantum leap in Tehran's military prowess.
If push comes to shove, Iran would not shy away from directly attacking Israel's nuclear infrastructure. The recent strike on the Nevatim military base near the Negev Nuclear Research Center, where Israel produces nuclear weapons, demonstrated Iran's offensive capabilities. For Israel, the attack was a significant blow and a clear indication of the increasing dangers it confronts in the region. The breach of its defenses and the boldness of Iran's strike exposed weaknesses in Israel's security system and raised doubts about its capacity to prevent and counter such attacks. Dr. Ameli, meanwhile, drew our attention to the role of the leader of the Islamic Revolution in the whole story.
The leader of the Islamic Republic is a wise and visionary figure, renowned for his integrity and a strategic vision for global peace. Like Marty Soleimani, he is a man of his word, steadfast in honoring his commitments. His pledge to retaliate against any attack on Iran's soil was fulfilled, enhancing his reputation across the region as a powerful figure against the hegemonic adventurers of Israel. Despite attempts to portray him negatively through projects like Iranophobia and Islamophobia, Operation True Promise, led by Ayatollah Khamenei, presented a true image of the leader to the world. It serves as a beacon of hope, showcasing a leader dedicated to freedom and the well-being of Gaza's people.
Mr. Mousavi also told us about the increased popularity of the leader after Operation True Promise.
طبق قانون اساسی جمهوری اسلامی ایران، مقام معظم رهبری فرمانده کل قواست.
According to Iran's constitution, the leader is the commander-in-chief and he is entitled to declare war and peace. We saw after Operation True Promise that the people of the region, especially the people of Palestine, expressed their great admiration for their leader of the Islamic Revolution. We saw the same admiration from people in other parts of the world. This shows that people of the world were waiting for such serious action against the Israeli regime.
After Iran's historic Operation True Promise, many expected a severe response from Israel, a regime that has long before the current escalation threatened the Islamic Republic with military action. But almost 10 days after the operation, as of recording this show, the regime has failed to show any meaningful reaction. Were all the threats only bluffs? After much deliberation and hours of meetings to debate a course of action, Israel reportedly struck Iran on April 19th in what appeared to be its first military response to the Iranian attack. The attack itself was so insignificant that brought about more humiliation for Israel, a regime that had long been threatening Iran with military action. Iranian officials' cool reactions to the strike revealed the insignificance of the attack. Why didn't Israel respond in such a way that was expected by many?
After Iran's attack on Israel, many expected a strong reaction from the Israelis who possessed nuclear bombs. But why wasn't their reaction strong? This time they seem to have been on the right track. They thought correctly that Iran would strike back. They knew Operation True Promise was a limited action, in which Iran didn't use all the items in its arsenal. The numbers of missiles fired were limited. If Iran had launched 3,000, 4,000 missiles instead of firing 300 or 400 missiles, could Israel have intercepted all of them? Or to quote from them, 99% of them. They know that the next attack from Iran could be irreparably destructive. In an all-out war with Iran, the regime has to fight against a country 80 times bigger than the occupied territories. These make the Israeli strategists think twice before plotting the next move against Iran.
Even within Netanyahu's coalition, Israel's limited counterstrike was not a clear-cut political win. Right-wing National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, for example, criticized the action on X as lame. Israeli officials talked about the need to send a message to Tehran and teach them a lesson. But the message sent from Tel Aviv was a self-humiliating message that the regime's bark is worse than its bite. Moreover, there is no guarantee that striking Iran is a good political move for Netanyahu or anyone else. According to Hebrew University polling published last week, some 74% of Israelis oppose a counterattack if it undermines Israel's security alliance with its allies. Dr. Ameli told us that Operation True Promise was just part of Iran's endeavors to keep the Palestinian cause alive.
The Islamic Republic has consistently stood by Palestine, opposing Israel's occupation and enduring the consequences. With around 4,000 sanctions imposed on Iran, it is evident that these measures are linked to Iran's justice-seeking foreign policy, particularly its stance on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Despite the establishment of the Organization of Islamic Conference in 1969 to support Palestine and uphold Palestinian rights, some of its main member states succumbed to pressure from Israel, seeking ties with the regime. But as for Iran, the Islamic Republic and its people have paid a price to halt Israel's atrocities against the Palestinian population, and they are proud of it.
The apparent lack of a robust reaction from Israel has raised doubts about the true extent of its military readiness and its willingness to follow through on its threats against the Islamic Republic of Iran. So far, the regime has failed to respond to Iran's retaliatory attack the way it had vowed. Will this break in the cycle of tit-for-tat exchanges signal a lasting peace, or is it merely the lull before the storm?
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again to see what else is on. You can also follow us on Telegram and X. Till next time, take care.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. Former President Donald Trump holds a clear lead over President Joe Biden in four of the seven battleground states that will likely decide the 2024 presidential election. Also, voters in battleground states say the economy is a top issue for them in the upcoming election. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Voters' impressions of how good each presidential candidate is for the economy could determine the outcome of the 2024 presidential election. In Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, where President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump are engaged in close contests, most voters said the economy will be the major factor in deciding whom they will cast their ballot for, according to results from a CBS News and YouGov opinion poll. In Michigan, 80% of voters say the economy is a top issue for them, followed by 77% of voters who say inflation is the top issue. 72% of voters rank the state of democracy as one of the issues that matter most to them. Joe Biden currently has a narrow lead over Donald Trump in the state. In both Pennsylvania and Washington, 80% of voters similarly rank the economy as one of the topics they care most about this election. Other lower-ranked topics included candidates' stances on gun policy, on crime, the U.S.-Mexico border, and abortion. It's so evident that the economy remains a central issue, but how people interpret the economy, the issues they want addressed to deal with their own economic situation, that's a complicated question with complicated answers, according to CBS News' chief election and campaign correspondent Robert Costa. About 6 in 10 people polled by CBS News said they rated the economy as fairly bad or very bad, despite economic measures such as low unemployment, growing wages, and a resilient stock market, which points to a strong U.S. economy. That could pose a challenge for Democrats, who Robert Costa said are eager to get the labor voters, the union members, to vote Democratic and pull ahead of Donald Trump. They know that those working voters at times hear the call of the Trump campaign and his message on immigration, and it can be appealing to those voters, and so that's why Democrats are really trying to focus on the economy by focusing on labor. The American newspaper, the New York Post, has a different angle on the same story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump holds a clear lead over President Joe Biden in 4 of the 7 battleground states that will likely decide the 2024 election, and is narrowly ahead of the incumbent in 2 other states, according to a new opinion poll. The Bloomberg News Morning Consult swing state opinion poll showed Donald Trump leading Joe Biden by 7 percentage points in Arizona, 49% to 42%, by 6 percentage points in Georgia, 49% to 43%, by 8 percentage points in Nevada, 51% to 43%, and by 10 percentage points in North Carolina, 51% to 41%. The Republican, Donald Trump, also led his Democratic rival by 4 percentage points in Wisconsin, 48% to 44%, just inside the poll's margin of error. In Joe Biden's birth state of Pennsylvania, Donald Trump led the president by a single percentage point, 47% to 46%, while the president held a 2 percentage point edge over Donald Trump in Michigan, 47% to 45%. Across the 7 states surveyed, Donald Trump led Joe Biden by 49% to 43%. With the inclusion of third-party candidates, Donald Trump had 45% support to Joe Biden's 40%, while independent candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had 7% support. Independent, Cornel West and Green Party candidate Jill Stein each received 1% of the vote. Joe Biden won 6 of the 7 battleground states surveyed 4 years ago, with North Carolina the only state going to Donald Trump. Swing state voters said the economy was a top issue with almost 6 months to go before Election Day, with 82% saying it will be very important in deciding whom they vote for and 34% saying it would be their single most important issue. Immigration ranked 2nd, with 15% saying it was their top issue, while abortion and democracy were tied for 3rd place at 9% each. 7 of 10 respondents said they viewed the US economy as going in the wrong direction, while 57% said the same about the economy in their own state. The bad poll numbers for Joe Biden come despite his campaign spending $30 million in the month after his 7th of March State of the Union address on advertising buys and campaign stops in critical swing states, a push that Democrats dubbed the month of action. The president's campaign has emphasized Joe Biden's record on abortion and attempted to draw contrasts between him and Donald Trump on the economy and the direction that the country is going. A large number of voters are unhappy with their choices, with Trump and Biden both getting dismal favorability numbers. In the 7 swing states, 44% said they had very unfavorable views of both major party candidates, with another 12% saying they viewed Biden in a somewhat unfavorable light, and another 9% saying the same about Donald Trump. Just over half, or 52% of respondents, said they thought America was better off under the 45th president, and 51% said their personal financial situation was better under Donald Trump as well. Social Security was also an important issue for the registered voters surveyed in the poll. 77% of voters said they liked the idea of a billionaire's tax to boost entitlements coffers. More voters found Joe Biden trustworthy in handling Social Security and Medicare by a 6 percentage point margin, 45% to 39%. Americans realize if they want to make gas cheap again and keep more money in their pockets, they must vote for Donald Trump, campaign National Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt told the New York Post. Joe Biden's economic policies are robbing people of thousands every month, and Joe Biden is doubling down, promising to sign the largest tax hike in American history if given another 4 years in the White House. The Biden campaign did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The Bloomberg News Morning Consult Opinion Poll had a sample size of 4,969 registered voters in 7 swing states, 801 registered voters in Arizona, 802 registered voters in Georgia, 708 registered voters in Michigan, 450 registered voters in Nevada, 703 registered voters in North Carolina, 803 in Pennsylvania, and 702 in Wisconsin. The survey was conducted online from 8 to 15th of April and had a margin of error of 1 percentage point across all the swing states.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hundreds of thousands of people rallied across France on International Workers' Day, also known as May Day. France's police have been constantly reprimanded by top NGOs and even by the United Nations for their infamous brutality, but security forces use tear gas, violence, and arrests against unarmed protesters, women, and children. Stopping governmental violence abroad was the primary theme of this year's march, with many unions declaring their support for Palestine amid Israel's attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza.
Palestine has become the most important problem in the world. Israel's war has crossed every line of humanity in warfare. It's not a war, it's just a massacre. So on a day like today, the demand for peace is on everyone's lips.
Support for Palestine was everywhere among the tens of thousands of marchers in Paris, with the link between Palestine and International Workers' Day crystal clear to